It is actually a pretty decent day for this. The 14th of January as the month keeps chugging along. Welcome back to the show. It's Sheldon McLeod with you here on News 95.7. And really glad to have an opportunity here to spend a little time with you over the next 4 hours. Lots to chat about. In fact, a little bit excited. Yes, I am. About Miles Goodwin. He'll be in the house. He'll be here with Dr. Stan Van Doise. They are involved with a campaign called Soulful Caring. Perhaps you heard Hillary's story about that here on the air today. We're going to chat with him about that. That'll be coming up in the next hour or so. We're also going to hear from Juanita Rodenizer. Her daughter, Haley, was taken to the hospital before the holidays. And no, it's just the flu. And it didn't seem to get a whole lot better. Back to the hospital they went. Yeah, just a flu. Well, it turns out it wasn't the flu. Her daughter's now being treated for cancer. A touching story in a community that's come together to support the Rodenizer family. We're going to speak with them coming up before 3. We'll also check in with Kevin Lacey, the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. Heard the news today. Laurel Broughton has been appointed the chair of the Nova Scotia Business Inc. And what does that mean? Well, we're going to hear some reaction from Kevin Lacey coming up. Noticed on the way in on the 103 today that the roads weren't, you know, they weren't horrible, but did notice there were an abnormally large number of vehicles on the side of the road with the hood up. And this weather is very trying, very testing for your vehicle. Well, he's been an automotive instructor. He's got his own automotive consulting company. And Doug Bethune, who's going to join us in the program this afternoon. Looking forward to that chat. Coming up just before 4 o'clock, a young man from the city, a musician, was out putting up posters on light poles to promote a rock show, a show that they were hosting. Turns out a police officer happened along, asked him what he was doing. He complied, told him, ended up with a big old ticket. And now, Justice Wiles, will be telling us how that fight went in court. He had his day, and apparently the ticket didn't stick. We're going to talk about municipal matters this afternoon. Have a couple of guests to join us, along with Tim Bousquet of the Halifax Examiner. Ruth Davenport will join us for the first half hour. After that, Councillor Way Mason. No doubt we'll talk about the Wellington Street development. Also about the patronage appointment of Laurel Broughton to run NSBI. We'll chat a little bit about train whistles and signs and the Dow Dental School and just about anything else that you'd like to discuss on the program this afternoon. Coming up after 5, it's Dalhousie Student Union and Gender Women's Studies Program. They're holding a forum tomorrow on the fight against misogyny. We're going to chat with them about that. We're going to hear from Dr. Gary Block. He's at Dal to talk about how doctors might help end poverty. We'll also get a rundown of some of the facts of Halifax with a couple of Halley famous folks. Hillary Windsor, yes, our very own Hill, and Mark Adrian, her partner in crime, or at least when it comes to being, if you want to accuse them of being history nerds. That is pretty much the lineup, but right now at 2:03, we're going to draw our attention to a story that hit my radar while it was off over the holidays, and I thought this would be an absolutely perfect opportunity to talk about some of the work that's been going on. We mentioned one of the guests on our show this afternoon will be talking about her daughter's battle against cancer. Apparently, Dalhousie researchers have been working at a combination of drugs that actually shut down tumors. Sounds like exciting stuff. And to find out a little bit more about this, we head to the phone line and say good afternoon to Doctor, I didn't get my Italian lesson, so I need some help here with your name.
It's Paola Marignani.
Marignani?
Yes.
Well, welcome to the show, and I hope you're feeling better.
Thank you so much.
You've shaken the flu bug.
I have, I hope.
It sounded like actually the influenza was making its rounds through the faculty there, and not just your department. There seemed to be more than a usual number of people out.
Well, that's what a virus does.
Yeah, true that.
It likes to move around.
Absolutely. You know, this report sounded very exciting. And there's this ongoing discussion that, no, science is a cure for cancer. It's just there's no money in that. Tell us about what work you've been doing.
Well, my research team, we've discovered a new combination of drugs that will inhibit the growth of breast cancer in mice that have been engineered to develop HER2-positive breast cancer, similar to the cancer that many women, 25% of the women, will get.
Is this exclusive to breast cancer right now?
As a matter of fact, there could be application for other cancers because the genes that we actually targeted are also involved in the development of other cancers like lung cancer, pancreatic cancer, and prostate cancer. And so there might be application for other cancers as well, but we do need to do those studies to be able to confirm.
Wanted to ask, I've heard some suggest that we all have cancer cells in our body. It's not really a problem unless they start multiplying.
Well, we do. I mean, every day there's a few hundred of these sort of aberrant or abnormal cells that make it through. However, because if you're healthy, your DNA damage and your sensing machinery is intact and will go after and attack these bad cells and kill them off so that they don't manage to replicate and become a problem. And so every day we have, you know, cells that are just weird that happen to be floating about or moving around. But because there's machinery in place to actually identify these cells, the cancers don't develop. It's when the machinery goes wrong and there isn't a surveillance net out there that some of these cells make it through and eventually begin to replicate and reproduce, right?
So when we're talking about the current techniques or procedures to deal with cancer, what is medical science trying to do with the current methods? Is it about trying to destroy all cells or exactly what's going on?
Well, with our study, what we were trying to do is target specifically the cancer cells. And what we found was because we were targeting two specific what we call communication or signaling hubs, protein signaling hubs, what we wanted to make sure was that the drugs themselves did not affect the healthy cells. And we were able to confirm that the mitochondria or the energy-producing factory within the cells are not affected by these drugs. And so in theory, if these are given to humans with breast cancer, this type of breast cancer, the drugs will target the cancer cells themselves and leave the healthy surrounding tissue or cells alone. So that's unlike current treatments that are in place. Right?
When was it that you found that this combination, you've been doing research for some time. When was it that you found that this combination seemed to be effective?
Well, the first half of the study was actually completed in 2013, where we actually had to re-engineer the mouse and develop this mouse model of breast cancer. We then took the primary cells from the tumor, so we took the tumors and we grew the cells up in a petri dish, and so these are called ex vivo studies, and we tested or screened a whole bunch of different compounds for the right combination ex vivo, and then based on that, we then moved forward into the animals, because you can't, you know, to do a study with 50 compounds, it would be millions of dollars, so we had to sort of distill it down to a reasonable number of drugs, and we came down with four of them, I believe, and those were the drug combinations we tested in the mice. And so it took a bit of time to do the ex vivo studies, to develop the mouse model, do the ex vivo studies, and then immediately translate that into a preclinical trial that just came out before Christmas that everyone's excited about, including us, right?
Oh, no doubt. Did you actually have one of those eureka moments at a point? Did you go, wow, this is working?
Yeah, it happens actually every few months. There's one of those moments where I sit there and I think, oh my gosh, this is really going to work. And when we developed the mouse model, we weren't sure they were going to get cancers because, again, it's all a hypothesis. And so when the first cancer showed up, it was like exciting and one of those eureka moments that we have the right model, that we did the right model, right? Mm-hmm. And then later on when we started the preclinical trial and, we know specifically that the tumors start developing at 5 months, and because of the first study, we knew how long it would take for the tumors to get a certain size. And so by the 21-day drug trial, by the time the trial was done, in some instances, the tumors were either remained the same size or shrunk or disappeared altogether. And at that moment, you know that, okay, now this could be a fluke. We have to do more mice. And by the time you get to your 10th or your 12th mouse, you know you've got something viable and exciting.
So when do we move on to finding out whether this is the same case with people?
With humans, with people, well, we're in the process of trying to, you said at the onset that it's difficult for funding and to get funds, and so this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to find money to be able to continue these studies in the mice and hopefully mount a phase one clinical trial to test these drugs in humans.
Would that happen here in Nova Scotia?
I'm optimistic that it could happen here, but ultimately it's important to get the study done. And if that means having to leave, then we'll have to do that, right?
Right.
But ideally it would be optimal to be able to do it locally.
So obviously you've got a team of people who've been working on this with you.
It's a small team. A team of, you know, two to four. It depends on the students and their career paths, obviously. But it's usually myself and one or two students and maybe a technician, a research assistant.
So I was going to say, you don't have a whole lot of people in your circle to high-five about this.
No, but, you know, too many cooks in the kitchen, you know?
I hear you.
Coming from an Italian kitchen, I know. I know the rules of play when you enter into a kitchen, right?
And I love food. No, this is great. I was really pleased that we were able to talk about this, and congratulations. You know, with all the other distraction about education, I'm really happy to hear that this kind of work is going on and that it's not being, you know, pushed aside.
And thank you so much for the opportunity to share this with our community.
All right. Good luck, and we'll look forward to an update.
Great. Thanks. Right. Cheers.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Best. Dr. Paolo, and again, Margnani. Mm-hmm. Bueno. All right. We have lots to talk about on the show, and I thought that was an important issue to discuss, and we're really happy for the doctor to find some time with us. Yeah, really, a cure for cancer, at least a way to combine some drugs to shut down the growth of tumors. That is exciting. A never-before-used combination. All right, I won't talk about it anymore because I'll think of questions I forgot to ask. We're going to shift to a different type of help, a program that was developed to look for shoes and help out those who need help in our society. We're going to chat with a couple of gentlemen coming right up. Hopefully you'll be able to stick around for that. Stick around. All right, it's 2:15 as we roll through a sunny but chilly afternoon, and not a good time to be out in this weather without the proper clothing. That's part of the reason we have our guests in here this afternoon to talk about soulful caring shoes for the homeless, and we have two guests to introduce to you. First of all, we say hello to Dr. Stan Van Dyce. Good day, sir.
Good morning. Good afternoon, brother.
Good afternoon to you. And Miles Goodwin.
Hi there.
How are you?
Good.
Great. You know, this this issue of helping for the homeless, we've done what we can with this program to help educate. You know, there are people in our community who sometimes are less off, less fortunate. And reading some of the comments about you, Mr. Goodwin, you've been lucky enough to have quite a successful career in the business, but you've had some health challenges. Tell me about what it was about this particular cause that drew you in.
It just made a lot of sense. You know, and this was first brought to my attention by Stan, your Dr. Stan, my buddy, and he mentioned to me a few years ago the importance of the need for footwear for homeless. Mm-hmm. And I'm diabetic, and Stan is as well. So we have to take a special care of our feet. Mm-hmm. To be careful that we don't step on anything, have some kind of an injury which can develop into something quite serious, and the consequences of that. So you can imagine what it must be like for someone living out on the streets, you know, walking on Lord knows what. And with diabetes, you can't even feel it. You don't even know there's a problem until it's too late. So that's the other thing. You have to be able to check your feet. You have to be able to look, because you can't necessarily feel anything that you would. Mm-hmm. You know, we might not. So it was just a common sense. He said, Miles, you know, this is something that's needed out there. And so about 3 months ago, I spoke to Stan about it again. I said, why don't we do something now? Mm-hmm. Let's not talk about it anymore. Let's go. And here we are.
Dr. Stan Van Dyce, what is it about diabetes that affects the feet? Why does it manifest itself that way?
Eventually, all diabetics almost all diabetics get neuropathy, and from that point of view, either they get pain and or lack of sensation. So a person who doesn't have any sensation doesn't know when they're injuring their foot. I mean, they could be clipping their nails, cut into tissue, and create an infection. Also, because of the decreased blood circulation, the healing takes a longer time. Infection can set in. A lot of people know of diabetics who have had feet or legs amputated. because of this circulation problem.
Some people may ask, where does the diabetes come from? Is it part of the rock and roll lifestyle or part of the lifestyle of being a doctor?
Well, from my point of view, my father was a diabetic.
Okay.
And I wish I was in rock and roll, but I'm not. But my father's diabetic, and in my ancestry, we've all been very sweet people.
It's about insulin, the way that your body processes
yes,
sugar.
And resistance.
Right.
Insulin resistance.
You know, this is an incredibly wonderful opportunity to talk to you about Value Village. Value Village, you were there today to talk about this program and to launch, and a lot of people who have taken advantage of the wide selection. So what was it about that connection? How did that happen?
Well, we need three things, really, to make this work. And we need somebody that can collect, and they were perfect for that.
Yeah.
Value Village is perfect. It could be the old home mission somewhere in the bowels of a city, and people don't necessarily want to go there. They might not feel it's safe, or they might not be comfortable going into certain areas where these shelters are available.
Or no parking,
and for all kinds of reasons. That's right.
Yeah.
And Value Village is perfect. You know, you can drive up in your Volvo, you can pop the trunk, ring the bell, they'll be there, they'll take your stuff, they'll have the room, they'll have the storage, they'll know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. That's what they do.
And
every day. So that was a great connection, and that's what I thought of right away. I want Value Village. There's 125 to 135 locations across the country, okay? They're associated with the Canadian Diabetes Association.
Right.
I've been working for the Juvenile Diabetes Association for almost a decade, so there's a real connection there. Mm-hmm. And so what they do is they get the shoes from Value Village to the people that distribute them. In this case, it's Shelter Nova Scotia. It's real teamwork.
Absolutely. Yeah. It sounds like this partnership was just waiting to happen. You said it really got rolling just before Christmas, part of Boxing Day?
Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, it started on Boxing Day. We only started talking about it about 5 weeks before. It's going so quickly, so...
And we've spoken about it at least 5-6 years ago.
Yeah, it was a long time ago, the first time we talked about it, and it stuck in the back of my mind. And this year, because this is my first winter off, April Wine has me, you know, pounding the highways this time of year often. So I said, because I was thinking about retiring. You may have heard, you may have not, but I decided to put in another year in the band, but I'm going to just limit the work.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, so I'm not working this winter. What am I going to do with myself? So I have some projects, and this is the one I spoke to Stan about, and this is the perfect timing in that regard, you know?
Doctor, I'm going to ask you about being on tour with Miles Goodwin here in a second, but when I talked to a friend of mine about April Wine and Miles Goodwin, you used to play everywhere. You guys played in every hall, and in fact, a good friend of mine said, I remember when they played down on the South Shore as Prism. And I said, Prism? It was a different name?
Different band. No.
So, but you.
I had a band called the Beatles too. That was a different band. No, the Prism had nothing to do with April Wine. Other than that, there were some members.
Guys.
Yeah, a couple of guys used to be in a band called Prism.
Yeah.
I used to be in other bands, and the other one was another band. So, this Prism thing is really not about April Wine.
No, not at all.
No, never was.
Just one of those rumors. One of those.
Yeah, urban legend kind of things.
You know, and that whole lifestyle gives you an opportunity. People know who you are from the work that you've done, and a little bit different than talking about this, the cause, the shoes, and helping people who are soulful caring. Wanted to ask you about your recording, just a quick second here. I know there are all these videos and TV shows and a lot of talk about the recording process. I cannot for the life of me find any stories about Miles Goodwin in the studio. You guys used to layer so many tracks, and you were really vanguards in a lot of ways of creating that sound that became so defined. Your voice and then the sound of the guitars, the wall of sound. Nobody ever recorded, documented? There weren't people in the studios?
Not so much, I guess. You know, I mean, one of the projects, I have several projects over the next 5 months and over the next year. And one of the things is I'm writing my memoirs with a fellow named Martin Melhuish, who's well known in the industry. He knows everything about everything in this Canadian music industry. And he's got half a dozen books himself, authored half a dozen books himself. So he's helping me write my memoirs, which will touch on the recording that we did in the sounds. But basically the sounds, you know, an ideal recording is what you do is, you have your source and then you want to record it. So if the source is wonderful, if you got, you know, Gary Moffat, one of the Maple Boys from April Wine, playing a vintage guitar through a wonderful Marshall, and the source is brilliant. He's got his own sound. Nobody can sound like Gary. It comes from our hands.
Yeah.
It comes from us. You know, can that same guitar to Dr. Stan, it'll sound like crap. Probably.
Thanks a lot, pal.
No. Seriously, though, you know, and the technique of multi-tracking and all that, you know, we didn't start that, but we sure got involved and did things our way.
Absolutely. And a lot of people remember you for being so connected. And I heard a comment from, actually, it was one of the guys in the Crosby, Stills, and Nash. You know, back in the day, we'd sell records. Now we make money from bums and seats. And in a way, that's how you started, though. It was bums and seats or people in arenas or community halls.
Yeah. Well, that's part of the whole package. I mean, what he's referring to, I guess, now is just the sale of, you know, the product. Everybody's down, you know, downloading and streaming and all that kind of stuff. It's not quite the same. I mean, everybody got, you know, everybody sold a million records. Anybody was anybody, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, we did. We sold 25 million records over our time. We're not going to see those numbers again. I mean, new bands are lucky to see that numbers in terms of a product, you know, the actual buying of a DVD or a CD, I should say. You know, they're probably not going to sell a million because so many people are downloading for 99 cents a track at a time or whatever, or just stealing. It's so easy to steal now, you know.
That said, if you go on YouTube, there's a platform there that there's an opportunity for anyone who has some talent to now be seen by the world.
Yeah.
And that is this going to pretty much eliminate the fact that we're going to have only a few, there won't be another Elvis, that there are just, you know, many, many, many people who are very talented, and that we kind of dilute the pool that way?
Well, I don't think so. I think the real Elvises and that are going to come forward. So the young talent out there now that's really making a difference, they're great. They'll be found. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the problem is you've got a lot of people out there releasing crap. That's the problem. Is everybody's got a studio and everybody's a producer and everybody can sing with the aid of all of these things like auto-tune and all the rest of it that we talk about.
Yeah.
So, you know, who are they fooling? Just themselves.
Sounds like a song. You know what, Doctor? I jokingly said, you know, on tour with Miles Goodwin, but you're getting a chance to spend some time. You two live near each other? Is that the relationship?
We both live. I live in Montreal itself, and he lives around Montreal.
Right. And so this relationship, you decided to come out and help spread this message?
Yeah, well, no. We met several years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been in contact all along. I've been to a concert or two of his, and this whole idea was spawned, and he remembered it, I remembered it, we talked about it. He said he was not going to be on the road for the winter time. He had times off. He said, you want to do the project? I said, sure, let's go do it. That was the best time in the world.
Yeah.
And the fact that we're coming here in Halifax, he's born in this area, he's known here. I'm just a stranger around here. I don't even know what had any address in Halifax, but it's just nice to see everybody that, you know, gravitates towards Miles because of his talent and his previous performances.
As I had mentioned, you know, obviously this gives you an opportunity as someone who is known, that people know who you are, and that this message is important to you for very personal reasons and for the societal reasons. And, you know, real pleasure to be able to speak with you about this. So are you guys traveling in a van?
We don't know. The next guy that picks us up might be in a van. We have no idea. We're traveling by cab right now, and from here we're going to the hotel and heading for the airport.
Righto. And this tour is taking you across the country.
No, this is the first project. It was campaign. It's called a campaign.
Yep.
And this is our very first campaign. That's why it was important to be here in person. And
absolutely,
to meet all the volunteers and so forth and get involved and talk to people about it.
Fantastic.
And this will happen hopefully at least once every year around the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe twice. We'll see how it goes.
Well, if I came here alone, I'd be Doctor Who.
I love that show, though. The TARDIS says hello. Again, thank you for both of you spending a little time to educate us on this. There's a website. Have you set that up yet?
Being set up right now.
Is it?
It's being set up right now. Okay. It'll be open very soon. It'll be Soulful Caring.
Soulful Caring.
Shoes for the homeless.
S-O-L-E. Soulful Caring.
Yes.
And
Soulful.
Socks.
And, well, yeah,
and
absolutely.
Boots and slippers.
And, you know, I had a guest in just before Christmas, and we were talking about when you run across a panhandler or someone, and in many ways, people go out of the way to ignore them, that, you know, you'll cross the street. And his advice was, even if you don't have anything to give, acknowledge them as a human, look them in the eye, ask them how they're doing.
Sorry for interrupting, but this whole thing really happened back in early 2000s, I think 2000, 2001. I had to get rid of a pair of shoes, which my wife insisted, you know, you get rid of this pair of shoes or I divorce you. So I purposely put them in my trunk in a bag, looking for a person 6'4" who was homeless.
Yeah.
And I found one and I gave him the bag. I said, here, this is a gift for you.
Beautiful.
And it went on from there on, you know.
couple of caring guys. Thank you very much for joining us in the studio here this
evening. Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks for your support.
All the best to you both. All right. We're going to take a quick break, a news update, and we'll be back with more of our show right here on News 95.7. You know, that was kind of fun. They left. Okay, so when will that be on the air? And I said, it just was. They've been doing some media stuff, and they didn't quite realize we were live. Yes, we were live with Dr. Stan Van Dyce and Miles Goodwin, and we were just talking about the whole Prism thing. And I knew it wasn't the band Prism, you know, the one that recorded albums, and but in true form, Janet, our the lady that runs his place out of the front desk, we had to call Adam, call them a cab for their next journey. And Janet said, calling a cab, sure. The name? Goodwin. Miles Goodwin. All right. Thanks. Hey, there's a picture up. That's a pretty good picture of Miles Goodwin. Looks like rock and roll, man. Got the glasses on the whole bit. A little bit of stargazing here in the studio this afternoon, and we'll direct you to their website. It's not quite up yet. They're working on it. Soulful Caring is the name of the project to get shoes for the homeless. We'll go from stargazing to stargazing. It kind of all works out, doesn't it? Welcome to our program. We say hello and good afternoon to David Chapman of the Royal Astronomical Society. How are you today, David?
Great, Sheldon. How are you?
I'm doing very well. And are you an April Wine fan?
Back in the day, I think I heard some songs by them, but I didn't live here at the time.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of a local thing. But they, I believe they toured around Canada and the States quite a bit.
They did. They spent a lot of time on the road. So where did David Chapman grow up?
Well, that's a long story. I don't think you have time for that.
No, we got time.
But I spent... we're talking about astronomy. So let's start with when I was 8 years old in Winnipeg, mm-hmm. when my dad took me outside and showed me the constellations, and then we moved around a bit, and I ended up in Ottawa,
okay.
Where I went to university, then out to Vancouver, and I've been living in Halifax since about 1977.
You had a hard time settling down, eh? I'm kidding, David.
More than half of my life here, so.
You know, you mentioned Winnipeg, and I distinctly remember being probably around the same age as you were, 8, maybe 9 years old, living in Saskatchewan, in Regina, and I could quite literally leave my house, get on my bicycle, and drive to the edge of town. Like, I'm talking, it went from paved road to dirt road to prairie, and it was nothing but sky. It really was an amazing, and I can only guess that's part of the reason that that you got that bug.
You're probably right. When I actually lived in a place called Transcona, that was outside of Winnipeg, and the end of the town was across the street. There was just a big empty field, and there weren't so many lights around as there are now, and they weren't as intense, so we didn't have that light pollution that hides the beauty of the night sky. So, you could see the Milky Way, and you could see the constellations. And, a lot of people growing up in the cities just miss out on that these days.
I say we're somewhat illiterate when it comes to knowing what is above us, the constellations. And I can't think that, there must have been a time where it was that important. You either had to stare at the fire or look at the sky. And much of what we know came from people who took the time to pay attention.
Yeah. I tell young people when I tell them about the constellations and try to explain about the stories and the patterns and what it meant to people. I said, back in those days, the sky was the big screen TV.
Mm-hmm.
There was no TV or even books or, computers and things. You told your stories outside and you looked up at the sky and you used that as your device for remembering and seeing patterns and that's what it was all about. And all around the world, different cultures would look at the sky. They would see the same stars pretty much as everyone else, but they made up their own patterns and their own stories.
You mean Orion wasn't always Orion to everyone?
No. If you go, for instance, down to the South Pacific, the Maori have a whole different set of stories about the stars related to Orion, and they don't even see the same constellation. They might take stars from one constellation that we know and join them with another and create even a bigger pattern. Mm-hmm. So the one here in Nova Scotia, like we look up and we see, oh, there's the Big Dipper. But the Mi'kmaq natives looked up and they saw a bear and three hunters chasing the bear. And in some places, the hunters were actually birds. And then there's four more birds that come from another constellation called Bootes, or the herdsmen. So there they had a whole story and a set of characters that the Greco-Roman tradition sees as two completely different constellations.
You know, you're touching on some really interesting stuff I find fascinating. And you know, what about the planets? And they would appear, disappear, they would show up in different, you know, that whole thing. And trying how you would track that and how they could get their heads around, you know, that kind of cycle.
Well, you know, the word planets comes from a Greek word meaning wanderer. So they recognized early on, people recognized there were certain lights in the sky that didn't keep their positions with respect to one another, but moved around. And so they had special significance for them. They didn't know the essence of them. They didn't know what they were, but they applied gods to these planets. They thought they were special. And so you have, you know, you have Mercury, the winged messenger, and, you know, Venus, Aphrodite, the goddess of beauty, and Mars, the god of war, and Jupiter, the, you know, the king of the gods, and so on. So that's how they viewed them, and they had a sort of a knowledge. They saw the patterns, and it took a long time for people to figure out how they moved and why they did these funny loops in the sky. That took a long time to figure out.
I can only guess that an appearance of something like a comet would have been extra special.
Yes. And, you know, I'm one of the fortunate few that have had the awesome experience. And I use that word very carefully. I don't usually use the word awesome, but I can only say that when I saw Comet Hyakutake back in 1996, it was a great comet that stretched across the sky. I mean, the thing you read about in books and see in movies, but this is the real thing. And I was awestruck when I saw it. So, and I'm a sort of an educated, you know, learned person. I knew all about the physics of it and so on, but it was still very striking. So imagine a time when people didn't understand what these things were. And in many cases, it would cause them to be afraid and to expect terrible things to happen, disasters. Astra stars, you know, stars that bring on bad things are disasters, right?
You know, so, you sent along a link to astronomynovascotia.ca, and
yes.
We shared that picture on our Facebook and our Twitter account.
That's great.
And that was taken by someone here in Halifax?
No, well, he's a member of the Halifax Center. That's Jeff Donaldson. He lives up in Elmsdale, and he's got a little observatory there, and he's been taking photographs of the night sky for some time. He's been training his telescope on Comet Lovejoy. It's been a bit of a challenge for everybody to view it and to image it because of the sky conditions. But he took last night he took a beautiful photograph, which is, I guess, now on your website, and it's on the Astronomy Nova Scotia website. I got his permission to use that, and it, you know, it shows an image of the comet that you wouldn't see necessarily with your eyes, because, you know, it's a time exposure, and so it shows some very faint, it brings out some very faint details, but it's a lovely picture showing the comet nucleus and the green, the sort of blue-green coma, and this beautiful fan tail coming out from the comet. When I look at it from the city in my binoculars, all I see is a little cotton ball. You know, I see like a star that looks fuzzy, but I know that that's the comet. It's in the right place and it's moving in the right direction. So, but yeah, he took a really nice picture.
And, you know, I'm looking at this image right now. It's on, I linked to it on the Sheldon McLeod Show on Facebook.
Right.
And it looks like it's moving perpendicular to the travel. You said it's a time exposure, and those long white lines are the stars, I assume, moving.
Yeah, so I think that's like over half an hour. The comet has moved that far with respect to the stars. So you're probably looking only at not even a degree, like not even a moon's width in the sky there. That's how compact it is.
Wow.
and it's moving along like a fraction of the moon's width in half an hour. So it's really, it doesn't, you know, shoot by like a meteor, but it motors along next to the stars from night to night. It's moving quite a distance. It only passed us by about a week ago, passed by Earth. Hmm. And so it's kind of heading closer to the sun and away from us. But, yeah.
How much longer will we be able to see it?
Well, there's a couple of factors there. It gets closest to the sun at the end of January, and then it'll go away again. So when comets are close to the sun, they're brighter. When they're close to the Earth, they're brighter. So right now, it'll be good until the end of January, except the moon starts to interfere. So right now is actually a good time to be looking at it. Up until about the 25th of January, you'll be able to see it without the moon in the sky. Mm-hmm. You know, so the amateur astronomers are really making the most of this little period of time here.
Yeah, I see Richard Zarowski saying it's going to be a partly cloudy night, so it might be a bit of a challenge.
But yeah, it'll be there on another night. It's not going away that fast. So.
Well, you know what? I was fascinated by this, and we certainly appreciate your time, and hope we'll get you back for the next celestial event.
Okay, then.
All right. Thank you, Dave.
Great.
All the best. Cheers. David Chapman, Dark Sky Promotion and Outreach, part of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada, Halifax Center. AstronomyNovaScotia.ca is a website that we were talking about if you want to surf on over, see some of the images, and perhaps learn a little bit more. Again, I'm kind of a nerd about that, but very grateful to have someone who's so learned, as David described himself. Coming up in just a second, can you imagine taking your 7-year-old to the hospital because you think, it's kind of like flu. It looks a bit like flu. To find out that it is leukemia. That's exactly what a family on the South Shore has found out. It's a battle that many people have had to fight, and it's one that they are taking on in a very brave way. We're going to chat with Mom in just a few seconds. We need a Rodenizer. That's coming right up. Stick around. It's 2:47 here on a Wednesday, right? It is Wednesday. The 14th of January, and still to come on the program. After 3, we're going to chat with Kevin Lacey, the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. He's going to join us talking about Laurel Broughton, appointed chair of the Nova Scotia Business Incorporated. We're going to talk about your car troubles. Doug Bethune, this time of year, the cold weather. You're going to find out if the battery is going to give up the ghost, probably sooner rather than later. Yeah, my check engine light came on. That's why I'm calling Doug. Need some advice. I'm going to check with a young man who, decided to promote his concert by putting up a poster. That's not unusual. He got a ticket. That's not totally unusual. He went to city council to talk about it. And now we'll get an update from Justin about that. But before we get too far along here this afternoon, you know, it's a horrible thing to see your child going through something horrible. And it's with some great strength and community support that this family is doing as great a job as can be expected. But wanted to just introduce you to Juanita. She and her husband, Leonard, found out that their daughter was quite ill just recently. And Juanita, thank you for coming on the show this afternoon.
You're welcome.
Tell me about your daughter. Tell me about Haley.
Well, Haley's always been, she's the youngest of our 6 kids. We have 5 older sons, and they're quite a bit older, ranging from 21 to 31, and she was a little bit of a surprise to us, and she was always a really good, healthy child, very energetic, outgoing, very happy, always smiling, and things really took a big change.
Yeah.
Over the last little while.
Tell me about that. I know actually a mutual friend of ours, I'd seen through his Facebook about some of the struggles. It started off, you went to the hospital, she wasn't feeling well?
Well, it started a little bit before that. The end of November, we went to the local community Christmas parade on the 29th of November, and she didn't seem quite to be her, her active self. She seemed a little bit tired and withdrawn, and she wanted to be there, but she didn't want to be there, and you know, things the next day, she just had a fever. So I attribute it to being out in the cold, you know, watching the parade and things. And
yeah, it was cold that night.
Yeah, and I thought maybe she was just coming down with a little bit of a bug. But she was never really a sick kid. She never had flus or, you know, anything like that. So I sort of kept an eye on it. And it went on till that was like the Sunday, I think. And the Thursday, I decided it was time to take her to the hospital and get her checked out. So we sat through the emergency room wait and took her in to see the doctor. And they thought maybe she had a common issue with children. It's called roseola. It's just a fever and cold-like symptoms that a lot of kids get, and they don't even know they have it. Mm-hmm. And the doctors were, you know, cautious, but they said, bring her back in a couple of days if the fever doesn't break. They didn't find anything in the few tests that they ran. And after that, I was giving her medication for fever, and her fever would go down and then come back up, and then go down and come back up as the medication wore on and off. But the Sunday night after that, which would have been the 7th, it seemed like her fever broke. She sweated. The next morning, her fever wasn't there, so I sent her to school. And unusual for me to have the school call me at work and say, you know, Haley's sick. She's burning up. She's looking green. She's complaining that her stomach hurts. So I went immediately to pick her up and took her right back over to the hospital. And the doctors in the emergency at Social Regional noticed something that I didn't, and that was the fact that the whites of her eyes were getting yellow.
Mm.
So I thought, okay, maybe this is a kidney infection or something with her liver, you know, jaundice type thing. And they, of course, she was dehydrated. They put her on fluids and took some blood. And within a couple of hours, they had called an ambulance for the IWK and knew what, or presumed what they thought it was based on her blood count. And so I went from having the healthiest child to having this happen.
I know. Acute lymphoblastic leukemia, is that what you've been told?
Acute lymphoblastic leukemia, yeah. Its shortened version is ALL.
Mm-hmm.
It is the most common, but because of her blood count, which was 80,000 or something white cells, they set her at a high risk. And she's since been moved to very high risk because her first treatment, which was over the last month, didn't get rid of enough of the what they call MRD, or minimal residual disease, and bring it down to the level that they wanted it to be at in order for her to continue with the high-risk treatment. So they've moved her to high-risk treatment, very high-risk treatment, because she's at, it sounds like a small amount, but it's 0.22
mm-hmm.
As far as leukemia cells go in her system, and that has delayed her treatment. Well, that has changed her treatment. What has delayed her treatment, which she was supposed to start today, her second round of treatment, is her, what they call the ANC, or the absolute neutrophil count, which is the antibodies or the immunities in your system.
Mm-hmm.
They have to be at a certain level in order to continue treatment, and hers is too low to continue treatment at this time. They're going to give it another week for her neutrophils to come back up so that she can continue on. And this is stuff that I never, ever thought I'd be talking about. And I know so much now about the blood and how it works in the system that I never wanted to know.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, have you ever had someone close to you who's gone through cancer treatment?
My husband's father
mm-hmm.
passed away with cancer 4 years ago. But it was... Adult cancer is completely different, and his family had a lot of adult leukemia as well. He had aunts and uncles and grandparents that passed away from adult leukemia. But it is completely different than childhood leukemia because it's harder to treat in adults. And it's usually, you know, it just stays in the body and progresses. With children, there's been more research with this, so much research over the years with this disease that... What was a 50-50 chance, you know, 5 years ago is now an 85% chance of remission. So that is what they're hoping for in her case is the better part of the 85% remission. But we have had cancer. I've had my mother passed away of cancer a few years ago as well. So there is cancer in our family, but this is something that they can't predict. It has nothing to do with genetics. They tell us it can happen to anyone. And the last time we were in for her last bone marrow biopsy, I asked the doctor, I said, it seems strange that I've been talking to a lot of other parents through the IWK and the Ronald McDonald House where we were staying, that their children were the same. They were really healthy kids, and all of a sudden this hit them. And I said, is this somehow connected, related? And he said that it was strange that I asked, because there is a study going on in the UK with regards to the correlation between extremely healthy children and the onset of this disease. Mm-hmm. So I tell my friends and family and anyone who wants to hear that your child may be healthy, but you still have to hug them every night and make sure that you're appreciating them, because it can happen so quickly.
Juanita, cancer is a scary word. Your family's living it right now. You did mention about how you've been educated and how it's you've learned a lot. We've heard people criticize our healthcare system. What's your experience been?
I have to say that the IWK and even the Social Regional has been exceptional with us, because they, although I did take her in once, there was no way for anyone to know at that point what this was. They wouldn't have put her through the tests on just a hunch. It wasn't until the second time that we went in, but I don't know the name of the resident who was at the Social Regional at the time that she was diagnosed, but he was a fairly new doctor there, and he did such a great job just to recognize it and get things moving so quickly. And once into the IWK, they admitted her on Monday night. They told us that they were pretty sure that's what it was, not to scare us, but just to have us prepared. They did her tests, her bone marrow biopsy, and her spinal and everything on Tuesday. They did the bone marrow on Tuesday and confirmed it. And then on Wednesday, they had everything in motion that she had her first treatment right away. So they had the wheels turning, and I think their hopes were that, it was early in December and that maybe she could be well enough to be home for Christmas, but unfortunately that didn't work quite as we had expected due to some other complications that we had due to treatment. So,
well, Christmas in the hospital is not good, but it sounds, from what I'm seeing, that your neighbors are really coming together, that one neighbor shaved his head and his beard just to help help with Haley as she's going through this.
Yeah, it's been rough on her as far as not having been sick before. Mm-hmm. And not knowing, what's going on and why they're making her feel worse. So that's the hard part for her. And, she's been upset by it. And her emotions are all over the place because of the medication and the steroids that she's been on and everything. And she lost weight and gained weight. And she wants to eat, and then she doesn't want to eat. And, it's like a temperamental child, but 10 times over. And our neighbor has helped out immensely taking care of things here, and he supported her by shaving his head when she decided that what she had left was not worth having there, because it just looked worse than having none. And the outpouring of support that we've had through fundraisers that people have organized and that are starting has just been great. I mean, my sister, Angie Broom, and my husband's cousin, Suzette Conrad, have done a lot of organizing. We've had help from other people and friends. Heather Bryan has been instrumental in helping my sister organize a dinner at a local restaurant in Bridgewater, Dan's Diner, that's going to take place next month. And I've had to leave my job, basically, for compassionate reasons, and it's neither of us have really worked over the last month that much. My husband just started back to work this week, and it makes it difficult when you're trying to run a household and travel back and forth.
Absolutely. Well, Juanita,
it's not a huge distance, but we still have to travel.
Juanita, all our thoughts are with you right now, and I really appreciate you sharing some of your story. It's a tough story, but I thought it was one that we could hopefully learn from, and we wish you all the best.
Well, I'd like to thank you and thank everyone else who's been helping out with everything that's been going on.
All right. We'll keep in touch, okay?
All right. Thanks.
Bye. Juanita Rodenizer, her 7-year-old daughter, Haley, is currently undergoing chemotherapy and cancer treatment. We got to take a quick break, and we'll be back with more of our show. Stick around.